Chapter 26. The tang of salty air was strong. A stiff breeze blew in from the sea, and Lemuel felt a pang of nostalgia as he thought back to the sweeping coastlines of Nordafrik. The waters around his home had long since retreated, but the exposed seabeds shared the memory of their days at the bottom of the ocean with the air. He shook off the memory. He needed all his powers of concentration. The port area of Tiska was heaving with bodies, sweating stevedores, teamsters, servitors, and loadlifters. The Cypria Selene was scheduled to break orbit in 4 hours, and the last-minute preparations for her departure were in full swing. Trucks, supply tankers, baggage lifters, and water bladders carefully negotiated the busy port, and the noise of horns and shouting drivers rivaled the roar of engines. The hot reek of burning metal saturated the day as shuttles and lifters screamed into the sky to deliver the last crew members and passengers to their berths. Few remained on Prospero, and a palpable sense of excitement suffused the port. Lemuel's nerves were stretched, bow-taut. Red-jacketed soldiers of the Prospero Spire Guard circulated throughout the port, and officious docket supervisors checked and rechecked passes and permits. Beside him, Camille walked with her hands clasped demurely before her. She wore a long dress of emerald green, cut low and embroidered with black lace around the hem, sleeves and collar. She had balked at wearing the noblewoman's dress before Lemuel had pointed out that a patrician gentleman's consort would need to be seen in such a garment. At this moment, that patrician gentleman was reclining in his palanquin, its ostentatious appearance enhanced by silk brocade and velvet cushions stolen from their living quarters. Bedecked in an exquisitely tailored suit, Mahavastu Callimachus was failing miserably to look like an arrogant nobleman of terror by looking down his nose as he tapped an ebony cane on the pillars of his conveyance. Only Lemuel was spared the indignity of disguise, wearing his beige remembrances robes to masquerade as Mahavastu's personal scribe and eunuch escort to Camille. That last element of his disguise had raised a smile as they planned how best to reach a shuttle bound for the Cypria Selene. At least, it had raised a smile with everyone, except Lemuel. Behind them came a team of bearers, 9 servitors carrying a collection of steamer trunks filled with a mass of papers, sketchbooks and grimoires written by Mahavastu in the years he had spent as Magnus's puppet. Lemuel had urged Mahavastu to leave them, but the old man was adamant. The past needed to be preserved. History was history, and it was not for them to judge what should be remembered and what should be forgotten. "I won't be a burner of books," said Mahavastu, and the discussion had ended. They had entered the port area without incident, for centuries of peace and an increasingly compliant galaxy had made the people of Prospero complacent. "So, how are we going to do this?" asked Camille. It was the first thing she had said this morning, for there had been a furious row the previous night, as she had told Shire of her decision to leave.
"Trust me," said Lemuel. "I know what I'm doing."
"You keep saying that, but you never say what you're going to do."
"I won't until the time comes."
"Well, that's reassuring."
Lemuel didn't reply, understanding the root of Camille's harsh words. They moved through the crowds, avoiding the main thoroughfares of wide-wheeled trucks as they ferried soldiers and crew to the loading berths. Tall-sided hangars, storage silos, and fuel towers made up the bulk of the port facilities, and they threaded a path between them as they wound towards the silver platforms built on the edge of the shoreline. A dozen craft growled in their berths, the last to join the orbiting mass conveyor. This would be their last chance to get off Prospero. Lemuel led them towards the launch bays as 2 more craft climbed into the sky on shrieking columns of jet fire. Camille walked alongside Mahavastu's palanquin, trying and failing to look decorous as the bulked-out servitors bore him without complaint. They made for an unusual spectacle, but one Lemuel hoped looked about right for passengers who had every right to be taking flight on the newly refitted Cypria Selene.
"This isn't going to work," said Camille.
"It's going to work," insisted Lemuel. "It has to work."
"No, it won't. We'll be stopped, and we'll be stuck on Prospero."
"With that attitude, we definitely will be," snapped Lemuel, his patience wearing thin.
"Lemuel, Camille," said Mahavastu from the palanquin, "I understand we are all under a lot of pressure here, but if it wouldn't be too much trouble, would both of you please shut the shitting hell up?" Both Lemuel and Camille were brought up short, shocked at the old man's language. Lemuel looked up at Mahavastu, who seemed, if anything, more offended than them.
"I apologize for my profanity," said Mahavastu, "but it seemed like the only way to restore calm. Sniping at each other is only going to end things badly for us all."
Lemuel took a deep breath.
"You're right," he said. "I apologize, my dear."
"I'm sorry, Lemuel," said Camille. Lemuel nodded and led the way downhill again. At last they reached the entrance to the shuttlecraft launch platforms. This time there was a security checkpoint, as not even the citizens of Prospero left such dangerous places unsecured. Spireguard manned the entrance to the shuttle areas, and blue-robed officials checked the identity of everyone going through to the launch platforms. "Now we get to see if all that training was worth it," said Camille.
Lemuel nodded. "Let's hope I was a good student."
They approached the checkpoint, and Lemuel handed over a sheaf of papers taken from one of Callista's notebooks to a bored-looking clerk. The words written there made no sense, but it would be easier if the mark couldn't understand them. The clerk frowned, and Lemuel took that as his cue.
"Lord Asoka Bindusara and Lady Komaradevi Chandra to take ship to the Sepria Selene," said Lemuel, projecting a confidence he didn't feel into the man's aura. "I am their humble servant and scrivener. Be so good as to indicate which of the waiting shuttles is the most regally appointed."
Lemuel leaned in and whispered conspiratorially,
"My master has grown accustomed to the luxuries of Prospero. It wouldn't be pleasant for anyone were we to be assigned a craft that wasn't a damn palace, if you take my meaning."
The clerk was still frowning at the words on the page. It wouldn't take long for him to see past Lemuel's bluff and understand he was looking at gibberish. Lemuel felt the man's bureaucratic mind processing the letters before him and increased his manipulation of his aura, siphoning off the sanguine and the bile. He crafted the impression that the documents were travel passes and berthing dockets for three passengers and their luggage. The clerk gave up with Lemuel's papers and consulted a data slate of his own instead.
"I don't see your names," he said with officious satisfaction.
"Please check again," said Lemuel,
edging closer as a trio of shuttles blasted off from the shoreline. He sensed Camille and Mahavastu's panic behind him and increased his mental barrage. Even as he did so, he could feel that it wasn't working. Lemuel heard a gasp of surprise from behind him, and a soothing blanket of acceptance settled over him. From the glassy look that came into the clerk's eyes, Lemuel saw it was affecting him too. Someone moved beside him, and a woman's voice said,
"There has been a last-minute addition to the passenger manifest. These are my guests aboard ship."
Lemuel smiled as Chaya rested her hand on the clerk's arm, feeling her influence spreading through him. It seemed every native of Prospero enjoyed a measure of psychic power, and he wondered how he hadn't noticed it before.
"Yes," said the clerk, sounding unsure but unable to say why. "I see that now."
He nodded as Chaya's certainty increased, and he waved to the soldiers on either side of the gateway. The clerk stamped a loading billet for their steamer trunks and handed Lemuel four berthing discs, each with a stamped eye at its center. Lemuel tried not to look as relieved as he felt.
"My lord thanks you,"
he said, as they swept through the gate. No sooner were they hidden from sight of the clerk and his soldiers than Camille threw herself into Chaya's arms and kissed her. They embraced until Mahavastu coughed discreetly.
"You came," said Camille, tears smudging the makeup around her eyes. "Of course I came," said Chaya. "You think I'd let you leave without me?" "But last night..."
Chaya shook her head.
"Last night you blindsided me with all your doomsaying talk, and the idea that you were leaving scared me. I don't want to leave Prospero, but if you think there's something bad coming, that's good enough for me. You've never been wrong before now, about anything. I love you and won't be parted from you."
Camille wiped her eyes with the sleeve of her dress, ruining the fabric, but not caring.
"There is something bad coming, I know it," she said. "I believe you," said Chaya, with a nervous laugh. "If you're wrong, we can always come back."
Lemuel nodded towards the shuttle the clerk had assigned them.
"We'd better get moving," he said. "Ours is one of the last to leave."
Their rag-tag group followed the directions of blue-coated ground crew towards the berth of a sleek lighter of gleaming silver. Its wide wings enfolded them in shadow as they passed beneath them, and its flat-bottomed cargo bay was slung beneath the berthing frame they had to climb to reach the crew ramp. Lemuel allowed himself a small smile of success. Camille and Shire laughed and giggled as they walked hand in hand towards the lighter. Even Mahavastu wore a smile. The smiles fell from their faces as an urgent voice called out,
"Stop! On the crew ramp! Stay where you are!"
Lemuel's heart turned to a lump of ice as he turned to see who had hailed them. A captain in the Prospero Spire Guard was leading a detachment of soldiers towards them.
"This looks bad," he said. "You have nothing to fear from me, Ammon," said Magnus. "You have been my most faithful servant since I first came to Prospero. I could never harm you."
"With respect, my lord, I am sure young Uthisar thought the same," said Ammon, picking his way gingerly through the wreckage of Magnus's chambers. His grey hair was kept cropped close to his skull, and his skin had the texture of aged vellum. He knelt beside Uthisar's body and placed his hand upon the cracked and seared breastplate.
The bodies of the Scarab cult lay around Uthisar, their bodies twisted in unnatural ways and their flesh blackened as though consumed in the same fire that had destroyed Magnus's library.
"Tell me what happened," said Ammon.
Magnus lowered his head, unwilling to meet his oldest friend's gaze. The captain of the Ninth made no accusations. He didn't need to. No accusation could carry greater guilt than Magnus placed upon himself. Almost a week had passed since he had killed Uthisar, a week in which he had almost given in to his self-destructive urges and turned his powers upon himself. Fearing the worst, others had tried to enter his chambers, but Magnus had kept them all at bay until now. Magnus looked down at the grotesquely crumpled body of Balak Uthisar and sighed with regret and loss.
"It was an unforgivable lapse and should never have happened," he said, "but he knew too much, and I could not let him leave."
"Knew too much about what?"
"Come here," said Magnus. "Let me show you."
Ammon rose and followed Magnus into the balcony overlooking the white city of Tiska. Magnus read the wariness in Ammon's aura and didn't blame him. He would be a fool not to be wary. In all the long years since they had first spoken as tutor and pupil, Magnus had never thought of Ammon as a fool. Magnus looked towards the noonday sky.
"Fly the great ocean with me," he said.
Ammon nodded and closed his eyes, and Magnus let his body of light float free of his flesh. The concerns of the mortal world lessened, but could not be wholly ignored. Tiska transformed from a place of cool marble to a glittering jewel of light, the tens of thousands of shimmering soul lights who called the city home like tiny lanterns.
"How fragile they are," said Magnus, though there was no one yet to hear him.
The warm glow of Ammon's subtle body appeared next to him, and they flew into a sky of brilliant blue. The world around them deepened from blue to black, the stars pinwheeling around them like darts of phosphor. The blackness of space transformed into the swirling, multicoloured chaos of the great ocean, and both travellers felt the welcome rush of pleasure as its currents flowed around their ethereal forms. Magnus led the way, streaking through the swirling abyss towards a destination only he was capable of finding. Ammon followed him, his dutiful friend and beloved son. At length they came to the region of stillness he had seen a week ago. He felt Ammon's horror as he beheld the vast fleet of ships, the slab-sided warships, the sleek strike cruisers, and the monstrous monuments to destruction that were the battle barges. Hundreds of vessels drew ever closer to Prospero, ships of many flags and many allegiances, united with one shared purpose, annihilation. Leading them was a feral blade of a ship, unsheathed to deliver the death blow to its hated foe. Grey and fanged, it prowled the stars with carved eyes at its bladed prow, piercing the depths of the great ocean with uncanny precision.
"Is that what I think it is?" asked Ammon.
"It is," confirmed Magnus.
They flew closer to the brutal vessel, the protective shields that kept void predators at bay no match for travellers of such power. They passed through its layered voids, diving down through metre upon metre of adamantium hull plates, integrity fields and honeycombed bulkheads until they reached the heart of the ship. The masters of this fleet gathered to plan the destruction of all that Magnus held dear, and the two sons of Prospero listened to their deliberations. Magnus was prepared for what he would hear, but Ammon was not, and the flaring wash of his etheric field sent a pulse of choleric energy through the ship's crew.
"Why?"
begged Ammon. "Because I was wrong."
"About what?"
"Everything," said Magnus. "All the things you taught me, I arrogantly assumed I already knew. You warned me of the gods of the warp, and I laughed at you, calling you a superstitious old fool. Well, I know better now, for I beheld such a being, and thought I had the better of it, but I was wrong. I have done terrible things, Ammon, but you must believe that I did them for the right reasons." Ammon drifted down towards the master of this vessel and the steely-eyed killer in golden armour who stood next to him on a raised command dais. A group of identically armoured warriors stood at the base of the dais, occupied by their leaders.
"The Council of Nicaea?" demanded Ammon.
"Were they right to name us warlocks?" "I fear they may have been, though only now do I understand that."
"And for that we are to suffer?"
Magnus nodded and flew up through the ironwork of the starship, exploding outwards into the seething cauldron of the great ocean. Ammon flew at his side, and they hurtled back to Prospero, exhaling pent-up breaths as they opened their eyes and looked down on the reassuringly familiar vista of Tisca.
"And the Legion knows nothing of this?" asked Ammon.
"Nothing," said Magnus. "I have drawn a veil around Prospero. None see out, not even the Corvidae. Now the Thousand Sons must learn what it means to be blind."
"So our punishment draws ever closer," said Ammon. "What happens when it gets here?"
"You are a kind old friend," said Magnus. "It is my punishment."
"Their axes will fall on the rest of us as well," pointed out Ammon. "I ask again, what will we do when they get here?"
"Nothing," said Magnus. "There is nothing to do."
"There is always something to do. We can destroy them before they even reach us," hissed Ammon, gripping Magnus's arm.
Magnus shook his head, saying, "This is not about whether we can defend ourselves against this threat. Of course we can. It is about whether we should."
"Why should we not?" countered Ammon. "We are the Thousand Sons, and nothing is beyond us. No path is unknown to us, and no destiny is hidden from us. Instruct the Corvidae to pierce the veils of the future. The Pavonian Raptora can enhance our warriors' prowess, while the Pirae burn our enemies and the Athenians read the minds of their commanders. When they come, they will find us ready to fight."
Magnus despaired, hearing only the urge to strike the first blow in Ammon's voice. "Have you not heard what I have said?" he pleaded. "I do not strike because it is what the powers that have manipulated me since I came here want me to do. They want me to take arms against our doom, knowing that if I do, it will only confirm everything those who hate and fear us have always believed." Ammon looked out over the city, and his eyes took on a faraway look, tears of loss streaming down his cheeks.
"Before you came to Prospero, I had a recurring nightmare," he said. "I dreamt that everything I held dear was swept away and destroyed. It plagued me for years. But on the day you arrived from the heavens like a comet, the dream stopped. I never had it again. I convinced myself it was nothing more than an ancestral memory of old night. But it wasn't. I know that now. I foresaw this. The destruction of everything I hold dear is coming to pass."
Ammon closed his eyes, and he gripped the balcony with white-knuckled fury.
"I may not be able to stop it," he said, "but I am going to fight to protect my home, and if you ever held my friendship in any esteem, you would do the same."
Magnus rounded on Ammon. "Despite everything I have done, my fate is my own," Magnus said. "I am a loyal son of the Emperor, and I would never betray him, for I have already broken his heart and his greatest creation. I will accept my fate, and though history may judge us traitors, we will know the truth. We will know we were loyal, and to the end, because we accepted our fate."
The captain of the Spire Guard stopped before him, and Lemuel reached out to soothe his aura. His terror made it difficult, but before he could reach out with any calming influence, he saw that the officer's aura was not expecting trouble, but racked with grief. Lemuel looked more closely, recognizing the breadth of the man's shoulders, the immaculate pressing of the uniform, and the gold frogging looped around his shoulders. The captain removed his helmet, and Lemuel dared hope this enterprise wasn't doomed.
"Captain Vitara?" he said.
"Indeed, Master Gowman," said Captain Socom Vitara of the 15th Prosperine Assault Infantry. "I hoped I would see you before you left."
"Before we left?"
asked Lemuel, confused as to why they weren't being frog-marched in manacles away from the lighter. The cargo bay doors were closing, and they would be airborne in a matter of moments.
"Yes, I almost missed you, because your names weren't on any of the manifests."
No, agreed Lemuel, with a guilty smile. They wouldn't be.
Still, I'm glad I caught you.
You are? Asked Camille.
Why? What do you want?
The young man struggled to find the right words, and in the end he gave up and just spoke in a confused torrent.
I don't know for sure what happened to Callista, but I know she does not want to remain here, he said, and Lemuel struggled to hold his composure in the face of the young man's obvious grief. She wants you to take her away from here.
Lemuel exchanged a worried look with Camille.
That could be difficult, he said.
I know I'm not making any sense, said Vitara, but she said that she wanted to leave Prospero with her friends.
And she told you this? Asked Camille, enunciating each word carefully so there could be no misunderstanding.
After she died.
Vitara's face was a mask of indecision and incomprehension.
I believe so, he said. I dreamed of Callista last night, you see. She was sitting beside me in Fiorento Park, and we watched the sunshine on the lake. We didn't say anything. We just held each other. When the Ravalli bell woke me this morning, I found a note beside my bed telling me to be at the landing platforms at this exact time. I don't remember writing the note, even though it was in my handwriting, but it was obviously Callista's words. She wanted me to be here, and she wanted me to give you this. Vitara accepted a pale blue ceramic jar from one of his soldiers and held it out to Lemuel. Simply crafted, it was an urn in which one might keep a beloved family member's ashes.
Lemuel took the jar and smiled and said,
"You know, I believe you are absolutely right. Callista did come to you last night, and since I am her friend, I will honour her wishes."
"Then you think she really came to me last night?"
"I do," said Lemuel, his own grief eased by the notion. "I really do."
Vitara saluted Lemuel and said,
"Thank you, Master Gammon. I'll miss Callie, but if this is what she wants, then who am I to deny her?"
"You are a very noble man," said Camille, stepping forward and planting a soft kiss on his cheek. "I see why Callie liked you." He smiled and nodded towards the crew compartment of the lighter, where an exasperated deckhand waited to close the hatch.
"You'd better go," said Vitara. "You don't want to miss the Cypria Selene's launch. After all, time and tide wait for no man."
"Indeed they do not," said Lemuel, shaking Vitara's hand.
The servitors loaded the steamer trunks into the lighter as Mahavastu climbed down from his palanquin. Camille guided the venerable scribe into the lighter as Vitara led his men from the landing platform. Lemuel followed his friends on board. As the hatch slid shut behind him, he had what he knew would be his last sight of Prospero. He was wrong about that. The Cypria Selene weighed anchor on schedule and eased clear of a berth with smooth grace. Silver jibs jutted into space from the central hub of the orbital docks, the space around it thick with manoeuvring warships. Thousand Suns battle barges slipped their moorings and set sail for the outer reaches of the star system, and squadrons of strike cruisers flocked around them as they departed Prospero. To coordinate so large a ballet of ships was no small feat. The FOTEP led an armada of ships with the power to level planets to the furthest edges of the star system, while the Ankh Tower, Sign of Prospero, and the Kimaru assumed equally angled vectors, leading fleets to the corners of the Thousand Suns domain. The order to disperse the fleet had come with the highest alert prefixes, and the four battle groups made best speed for their destinations. None of the captains knew the nature of the alert, but all had been given strict instructions not to unlock their orders until reaching their assigned coordinates. That such orders left Prospero dangerously undefended was clear to every shipmaster, but none dared disobey a direct command from the Primarch himself. Whatever the purpose of this dispersal was not for them to question. Their only duty was to obey. Military traffic took precedence over civilian vessels, and it took 6 hours for the Cypria Selene to work its way up the queue of ships awaiting a transit corridor. Eventually, the vessel's master steersman was able to pilot his way towards clear space and open up the plasma drives to take his vessel towards the Corward jump point. From there, warp willing, it would be a 3-week journey to the Thranks system. The angle of launch had been good, and instead of taking 4 days to reach the Corwood jump point, Cypria Selene achieved the necessary safe distance from the Prosperine Star to safely activate its warp drives in 3. The vessel's navigator confirmed the warp currents in the realm beyond were as calm as he had known them, and the master of cartography ran a final positional check before passing his jump calculations to the navigator's module. In the ship's observation dome, Lemuel and Mahavastu chatted about where they next planned to visit, while Camille and Shire held hands as they listened to the toneless jump countdown through speakers set into the wood-panelled walls. Set high on the rear quarter of the Cypria Selene, the dome provided a commanding view over the vast superstructure of the mass conveyor. Its hull stretched away from them for 60 kilometres, ending in a blunt wedge of a snout. For a vessel intended to carry vast quantities of war materiel, troops and bulk items of warfare and compliance, it was handsomely appointed. The four of them had settled into shipboard life with ease, and the cabins they had been assigned by the misdirected clerk were clearly intended for high-born passengers.
"Give or take, you should be on Terra inside 2 months," Lemuel told Mahavastu. "You'll be back at Utapartha, cataloguing old records recovered from beneath the ruins. I hear they've finished collating the data cores of Neo Alexandria, but there's bound to be more. They'd be mad not to want your help."
"Perhaps," agreed Mahavastu, leaning heavily on an ebony cane with a golden pommel inset with a jade eye. "Though I fear I may be too old for such excitement."
"Nonsense," said Lemuel. "There's life in you yet."
"You are kind, Lemuel," said Mahavastu, "but I think perhaps I will instead concentrate on my memoirs, what I can recall of them."
"I would be happy to read them."
"Happier than I shall be to write them, I feel."
Lemuel didn't reply, but simply smiled as Camille and Shire joined them at the edge of the observation dome. Perhaps 60 people had come to watch the ship translate into warp, either curious to see how so enormous a vessel could travel between the stars, or eagerly fearful to look into the mysterious realm of the warp. If only they knew, thought Lemuel, they would put out their eyes rather than look into a place of such dreadful power.
"Almost away," said Camille.
"Yes," said Lemuel, nodding towards the glass dome as the countdown reached 1 minute. "Part of me is almost sad."
Aerial-like veins extended along the entire length of the vast ship, causing the view to shimmer as void barriers powered up in preparation for the jump.
"Won't be long now," said Camille, taking Lemuel's hand.
"And then this will all be over," said Lemuel.
The count had reached 33 seconds when the alarm sounded. The automated voice was cut off by a burst of shrieking static. A series of emergency lights flooded the interior of the dome with a red glow.
"What's happening?" cried Mahavastu.
Lemuel had no answer for him, but was spared from admitting his ignorance by an explosion of shimmering, ghostly light off the Cypria Selene's starboard bow, as though a yellowed fang had torn a terrible wound in the fabric of reality. A blooming froth of light spilled out and illuminated space around the mass conveyor. It tore wider and wider, blistering streamers of unlight weeping from the wound like blood on a shroud. Vast forms moved in the swirling vortex, shaped like gutting knives. The first was a lean, feral-looking warship, its flanks slate-grey and brutally punctured with gun batteries and torpedo launchers. Its prow was shaped like a ploughshare, but this was no peaceable vessel. It was a ship of war. Its angles were harsh, its lines sleek. It was a hunter of the stars and a killer of ships. As it cleared the flaring tear in reality, scores of other fighting vessels jostled for position behind it. Golden craft, black craft, and a host of predatory vessels in identical livery to the fleet's leader. Lemuel had seen this ship before, in the heavens above Shrike, in the Arc-Reach cluster.
"Is that?" gasped Lemuel.
"Unfortunately, yes," said Mahavastu. "I rather think it is."
"You know that ship?" asked Camille. "What is it?"
"It is the Harankle," said Mahavastu, "the flagship of Lehman Russ."